The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs,
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
This is Zero Squared, the Zero Books Podcast. Welcome to Zero Squared. The guest this week is C. Derek Varn. Varn is a reader at Zero Books, a university lecturer and teacher currently living in Mexico, and my co-host on the Pop the Left podcast. In this episode of Zero Squared, we briefly discuss his new podcast, Symptomatic Redness, and then discuss the notion of cultural Marxism. Cultural Marxism is a concept and misunderstanding, mostly held by paleoconservatives and fascists. It's a term the far right deploys to describe a mishmash of often contradictory thinkers and concepts, including thinkers from the Frankfurt School, Gramsci, Lukács, and late 20th century feminist thinkers and standpoint epistemologists. It's Wednesday, February 11th, 2015, and I'm Douglas Lane, the publisher of Zero Books and the host of this podcast. There are several titles in production now for April. Eugene Thacker has two more horror and philosophy books coming out after his success with In the Dust of This Planet. And Justin Barton's book, Hidden Valleys, Haunted by the Future, is due out as well. Barton's book suggests that the future is always alongside us, sometimes closer, sometimes further away, which I guess means that all six titles due out in April are, in a sense, already here. In this podcast, you'll hear the voices of Herbert Marcuse, Eric Fromm, Rick Roderick, Sui Park, Lori Penny, Nikita Khrushchev, and Che Guevara. You'll also hear the music of Theodore Adorno, re-edited sounds from Mungo Jerry's hit In the Summertime, and also some Calliope music. At the very start of this podcast, you'll hear a few minutes from a YouTube video about the Frankfurt School and cultural Marxism. But don't worry, it won't last long. Right now, you're listening to music from Rick and Morty, the theme from that television show, run backwards through the dialectic. But in just a moment, you'll be listening to C. Derek Varn and I discuss cultural Marxism. Varn, C. Derek Varn, you are my co-host on Pop the Left, which is an on-again, off-again podcast we've been doing for a while, and you've started your own podcast called Symptomatic Redness, which I guess that would be a rash. But in any case, I've listened to an episode. I think it sounds like it's a continuation in some ways of what we do, in some ways very different. So I thought I'd ask you, what is symptomatic redness other than a rash, and how do you see the podcast developing?
Well, the podcast developed out of another podcast called Entitled Thoughts, which a 19-year-old economics student from India by way of Canada, or excuse me, but from India by way of Canada started.
Moved from Canada to India?
No. He's from India. He currently goes to school in Canada. And he was inspired by From Alpha to Omega, and he was very new to the podcasting game, so he did a couple of YouTube casts, basically, one of which is a five-hour conversation with me on a Marxist history of the education system going back to the Middle Ages. And he discovered he really liked talking to me, and he wanted to get my input from, you know, a completely different point of view from the left. He'd come out of things from the heterodox economic school and post-Keynesianism, modern monetary theory. And he didn't know anything about the activist left, and he didn't know anything about the Marxist left, although he was very interested in Marxist humanist and in Bordiga's critiques of economics.
Okay. So let me ask you this. He wasn't involved in activism at all. How did he come to left economics?
His high school years at an international school in Brussels corresponded with Occupy.
Oh, wow. He's really young. Yeah.
He's really young. I mean, and a lot of the people in our milieu are really young. So he wanted his own podcast. And I sort of told him, like, okay, you know, in this weird sort of teacherly way that I tend to do sometimes. And I said, look, we know, you've interviewed me 3 times. You've talked to me for over 9 hours. 5 of those hours are unedited on YouTube. And I'm like, you don't know how to podcast edit, which, it's true, he didn't. And, you know, I do. So, or at least I can relearn how. I had done audio editing on Mac software many, 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 many years ago. When I say many years ago, I mean like, it was OS X, like round 2. Went back and started editing some of our things. I set up a proper podcasting channel. And then, you know, he asked me, well, do you want to help me interview Philip Murawski? Do you want to help me interview Stephen Keen? And I was like, sure, but if I'm going to interview these, you know, post-Keynesian economics people, some of whom I respect because they do some good work on economic history, you know, you're going to have to let me interview these Marxist and anarchist people, and you're going to have to get involved a little bit more in talking to the activist side of things. And that's how we started. Now, the title, Symptomatic Redness, does refer to a rash. It also refers to it's a pun in a lot of ways. I used to say, for example, if someone asked me if I was a communist, I would say, I don't know, but I think I have a case of symptomatic redness. And the joke there was not so much that I didn't know what my politics were, that I had no idea how those politics mapped on to any, you know, actually existing Marxist movement, not even government, just movement in general. Because I have hesitations about everybody, as people who listen to Pop the Left kind of know.
Karl Marx revolution started as class warfare, in which he set the proletarians against the bourgeois, with the goal of creating a new proletarian world order. Due to the failure of the proletarian labor unions to bring about communist governments in Western Europe, the Frankfurt School, as well as the American Communist Party, shifted their efforts to mobilize women and minorities into the revolutionary ranks in America. The major advance towards this goal was the nationwide campaign against discrimination that led to a series of laws passed by the U.S. Congress during subsequent years. The Frankfurt School, a group of cultural or transformational Marxists, launched a program of psychological warfare against our American civilization. We need to know what it was and how it was set to work, because the Frankfurt schools were even more successful than the Communist Party in achieving its goals. Gentlemen, I would like to discuss a very important subject, the Frankfurt School. Dr. Nelson, would you tell us exactly and precisely what the Frankfurt School was?
The Frankfurt School was not a school in the traditional sense. It was not a building, although it did start out, it had a building when it began in Frankfurt, Germany. need to think of...
So yeah, let's talk about the Frankfurt School and cultural Marxism and that video.
It's one of like a half dozen right-wing videos about cultural Marxism I've seen in my life. That was particularly Christian-y, but...
You think that was done by a Christian group?
For sure it was, because the guy had a Christian flag in the background.
Well, I wasn't sure if they were a fascist group or a racist group or a Christian group.
Had to guess, and this is without looking up who those people were, they are a soft racial nationalist group and a Christian group. When I say soft racial nationalism, I mean, like, they're not fascist, but they do sort of believe in a white culture and, you know, patriotism in the American way. If you, like, watch the video, the funny thing is the very first guy who talks is obviously a nutcase, but the first doctor they have on who talks about the origins of the Frankfurt School, he's actually accurate.
Yeah, there wasn't a ton of things to disagree with him about. You know, the one thing that I wanted to question was just how hard a determinist Marx was and to what extent the Frankfurt School believed that Marx was an actual historical determinist or, you know, economic determinist.
So that's sort of 1102 questions, and we should get to that in the second half of the show. But I'll just say that I think that as a description of what the first and part of the Second International believed, not so much Marx per se, that's not wrong.
But the question is, the second part is still unaddressed. To what extent did the Frankfurt School agree with the Second International?
Frankfurt School believe that. That's really highly debated. So let's talk about the history of the Frankfurt School.
Well, let's stop and first things first. Just talk about cultural Marxism, what it is, and who uses the term, where it came from.
It comes from Gramsci, actually, more than Frankfurt School. I'm going to start off with two anecdotes to tell you my introduction to it. In 2002, I was sitting with my super, super conservative professor who went to the Sorbonne and taught me Hegel. I bring him up all the time. And I noticed he had two books on in his library that confused me. One of which was Gramsci's Prison Notebooks, and the other was Saul Alinsky's Rule for Radicals. And I asked him about it, and he told me, you know, we read that in the Reagan years, and we used that to win. And a friend of mine, now this is totally, this may be apocryphal, but a friend of mine who was a legal aide met Clarence Thomas once and saw his law library and says that the prison notebooks are in Clarence Thomas's library as well. Another irony is that a group of thinkers who are real thinkers, they're not like these quacks you see on this video. I mean, some of those guys are professors, but are serious theorists of the far right in Europe, called the European New Right movement. They're in France. They're mainly centered around two figures, Guillaume Fay and Alain de Benoist. And forgive my French, it's terrible. And these guys actually wrote for Telios, which was the Frankfurt School magazine at one point. Another far rightist, a different kind of far rightist, is a guy called Hans Hermann Hoppe, who is associated with the paleo-libertarian feudalism is better for liberty and business than capitalism than democracy is guy. He also says explicitly he's influenced by the Frankfurt School. So it's interesting because these rightists will talk about cultural Marxism, and that's their code word for the Frankfurt School, and that's a code word for what they would have called, you know, pre-1950 Judeo-Bolshevism. They don't talk about Gramsci because they can't make it about the Jews. But there is a history here that's interesting, not only on their side but on our side too, because there's a lot of stuff that they complain about, like politically correct culture and stuff, that's partly related to the Frankfurt School or one person in it. and partly related to the theoretician Grigori Lukács, who is an important figure for the Frankfurt School too. And in that sense, there is actually – they're not totally on crack. There is some relationship there. And it's really funny because I'll watch Marxists like rail about standpoint epistemology and intersectionality, which is the big words for what used to be called politically correct culture. But they don't know the history of it and its ties to Stalinism, because it has it. But generally, if someone says cultural Marxism, they are a paleoconservative or a fascist. Sometimes you'll meet mainstream conservatives who use it, but it's more of something you see on the fringe right. But even the mainstream right actually takes – they study this stuff. More so Gramsci and to a lesser degree Aka Lindsay. But they study it, and they also like to – they like to complain about it and like throw it off, but they use it probably more than the left does. So it's a huge bad faith move on their part. So yeah. So what is cultural Marxism, and what do they mean by it? For the right, it's a code word for political correctness, which they see basically as a conspiracy of a bunch of German Jewish intellectual Marxists who invaded the U.S. Academy with the help of the CIA. And actually, to some degree, that story is true. The Frankfurt School wasn't established by any government, but it was brought over by the CIA, actually as an attempt to fight Stalinism, believe it or not. So that, like, it was the CIA was a major part of the funders that got the Frankfurt School to the United States. Its members were largely Jewish, but not all. For example, Theodor Adorno, everyone talks about his Judaism. He doesn't really talk about Judaism that much at all, and he would not be halakhically Jewish anyway. So he wouldn't be seen as Jewish by Jews, but he was half Jewish. Max Horkheimer was brought up in an Orthodox family. He was important.
Well, now, what program did the CIA use?
They brought over the Frankfurt School.
Yeah, was that part of some sort of overall, like, larger effort for propaganda?
Building a non-Stalinist left in the United States.
So that they were funding left magazines in the United States at the same time.
We're funding
was it Ramparts?
Ramparts. They had funded people who were involved with WHO and the Women's Health Organization, and Gloria Steinem got some CIA money at one point.
That was later, though, right? The Gloria Steinem thing. But and then there was they were also funding artists. At least what I've heard is there was an effort to help abstract expressionism take hold around that same time. So all of this was a CIA funded left avant garde that was amenable to capitalism and anti Stalinist.
Think that that is happening to American man, and of course we're speaking not only of American man, but American woman as well here, Dr. Fromm, in relationship to his politics, to his political beliefs?
Yes, indeed. We have in the same way relegated our own responsibility in what happens to our country to the specialists who are supposed to take care of it, and the individual citizen does not feel that he can judge and even that he should judge and take any responsibility. I think there are quite a number of recent developments which show that.
Like, for instance,
that we are confronted with the possibility of a war of such destruction that the whole existence of our nation and of the whole world is at stake. And yet, people know it. People read it in the newspaper. People read that at the first attack, 100 million Americans might be killed. And yet, they talk about it as if they were talking about something being wrong with their carburetor of their car, perhaps.
Let's talk about the video a little bit more. I mean, people can go and watch it if they care to. They can sit through it. It's not the most entertaining. I mean, in some ways, it's entertaining. What my favorite thing at the start was the fact that you got the actor standing up and giving this kind of wacky, paranoid speech at the beginning behind a podium, and then in the next shot, he's in a wheelchair. And I was like, well, didn't we just see him standing? And then I thought to myself, why? Where are they? Where the hell are they? They look like they're in, I don't know, the set of Dr. Strangelove. Lots of curtains.
Like, to me, it looks like a 70s church building.
Okay, that's probably what it was. It was a big open space, lots of curtains blocking things out. And I thought, are they in a hangar? Are they on a stage in an amphitheater? Where the hell are they? They're in some place that seems like it has a, you know, they're not in somebody's living room. They're in some public institution of some kind or another. And it gave it a little bit more authority, I think, because of that. But it was odd. It was a parallel universe. So anyway, they start off by asking the bald guy with big ears to explain everything. And he does go through, like you say, a kind of a description of the Frankfurt School, which is only damning in implication just by assuming things about what's right in tonality, but it's otherwise not completely inaccurate. There were things that I questioned, you know, or thought, Marx maybe wasn't as determinist as they thought or as they're claiming, and this is sort of a bastardized version of Marx's vision. But it wasn't completely like out in outer space or something.
Well, but it does become out from outer space as they let other people talk. It's like they're trying to promote our patriotism and good working class patriotic values. But this is where the Lukács stuff comes in. Lukács emphasizes that alienation, reification, and class consciousness are the important thing, but he kind of sees class consciousness as something to be brought about by a vanguard educational movement. In this way, he's picking up on Kalski. And also, he's being a minimal to Stalin. He thinks that the idea of class, like working class consciousness as a sociological development, is a problem. And he goes on to talk about his theory of orthodox Marxism versus revisionist Marxism. But he does so by talking about, you know, praxis and all this other stuff. And a lot of stuff we read on to Marx is actually from this book. His readings of reification and class consciousness are basically the ones assumed by everyone from Trotsky to Mao, in a way. Even though Mao never read the book, it's just – it comes out of that.
And that's what people are railing against often, even on the left, when they are railing against crude Marxism, is they're railing against Lukács.
Look, this needs to be put into a very particular framework. He's writing in a way that has to be amenable to both the German Marxist left and to the Russian one. And he's writing in 1922. And so the developments that will lead to Stalinism are already beginning to happen. It's already there. He's already beginning to try to come up with the justification for, like, the Bolshevik reading of what the Vanguard Party is, and particularly its differences from the Kalskian reading, and both of those differences from the, you know, from Marx, who doesn't talk about consciousness in that way at all. He doesn't talk about consciousness in a way as something that should be organized by a party and you know, broken open. He doesn't use that kind of language, but Kalski does, and Lenin does even more so. And by the time you get to Stalin, there's just developments where that gets seen as, you know, a necessary thing. And consciousness is something to be brought about by the party. And this is this is even assumed in left communist circles. For example, if you read the writings of Bourdieu, one of the guys that I'm really influenced by, he has a similar idea about consciousness and the party as the organic brain of society, and it's the thought that thinks itself, sort of, but it's also apart from the working class, even though it's of it. And
let's pause here for a moment and compare what these guys in the video were meaning when they were talking about consciousness, and what Lukács was meaning when he would talk about consciousness, and how closely aligned they were. I mean, the problem of consciousness for Lenin was developing a revolutionary consciousness willing to, you know, go into battle against the bourgeois. It's at least how I, that's how I think of it. But there was the other level of it was a consciousness which would be able to sustain a new way of life, and which was kind of Marxist in its conception, because it was a consciousness that would be self-supporting. It would be a liberated consciousness. It would be working people creating their own productive activity and their own rules for that productive activity. And that's the other problem of consciousness.
And what those guys are actually reacting to is basically the first one, which is consciousness. And what they're saying that the Frankfurt School, you know, doesn't understand, and what they actually miss about the Frankfurt, they don't mention this at all, is the Frankfurt School is reacting to Nazism and Stalinism as much as it's reacting to the failure of a working class revolution. Like, they're as concerned about that as they are about the working class revolution itself. And of course, you know, these right wingers can't admit that there is distinction there. Because one of their concerns is your second definition of consciousness. They think the post-1927 Soviet consciousness isn't a liberatory one. So even if you had the consciousness to have a revolution, it's not a consciousness to sustain a completely different way of life. It's not new. And that is a problem that they're working out. They're also working out why in the Western countries there hadn't been a revolution. But that's more Gramsci than the Frankfurt School, and this is where things get confusing. Gramsci, in a essay called Lenin versus Capital, talks about basically Gramsci, in an essay on Lenin, says that Lenin proved that cultural hegemony could undo deterministic means of production. That's where he first started coming up with this idea of cultural hegemony. He had gotten this from Lenin, actually, that they needed to both understand the working class culture and also to change it. And that's where a lot of ideological critique comes from. And so if you could change the ideas about it and the superstructure, you could change the base. Now, from a classical Marxist perspective, this seems kind of backwards. So, yes, the article wasn't called Revolution Against Das Kapital. And he thought that Kapital was too fatalistic, and that, you know, the forces of production weren't necessarily primary, and all this. Now, Gramsci, you know, I have my own theories to this, but this is really amenable to professors. Not only is Gramsci a good writer and a more interesting writer than a lot of the people around him, and he has this tragic story. He was, you know, a very attractive but crippled man who was imprisoned and by a fascist and whatnot. But he fabled an idea about cultural hegemony that actually had come into being by this guy called Kaska, who was in the Youth Socialist Movement, which Bordiga, Gramsci, and Mussolini were all in. And he thought that Lenin plus Mussolini had proven that the cultural forces were more important than the forces of production. That's what they're impending on the Frankfurt School. Interestingly enough, the Frankfurt School doesn't believe that. They would think that the cultural forces are part of this assumption of life to capital, and that, you know, they talk about like the culture industry and mechanized jazz and stuff like that. And what they're talking about is something more aligned to, you know, what would be called the spectacle and situationism or whatever. It's the idea that all these things are coming out of the production, but they're reifying it and making it harder and harder to see past it.
Marcuse talks about the one-dimensional man. And on that, I think, is another way to think of the kind of culture that they thought that capitalism was producing. It was producing a culture of surfaces, a culture of consumption, and a culture of shallow, one-dimensional people.
The student generation that became active in these years did not need a father figure or a grandfather figure in order to lead them to protest against a society which revealed daily its inequality, injustice, cruelty, and its general destructiveness.
So in the paradoxical way, the Enlightenment builds up a kind of intellect intelligent enough to see through mystification. That's where I talked about Marx and Freud and other figures. We build up an intellect hard enough, as it were, to see through these mystifications. But any intellect that powerful has a tendency to become totalitarian. This is the fundamental problem.
So in this video, back to the video, just to kind of ground us here, I liked the part where he was talking about Pleasantville, because, you know, I had seen that, and and I thought his criticism was really interesting of that movie, or the way what he said that movie was doing, and how it was in line with cultural Marxism, and I just thought. Remembered my own critique of the Pleasantville, which is a movie where they get sucked into the TV and live in Leave It to Beaver and then change it because they're modern and sophisticated and more full of life, and they turn everything from black and white to color and all that. And I enjoyed the movie a lot. I think it's a fun movie, and I like Don Knotts in it. But I always kind of also thought it was a sort of a bourgeois movie. It was all about like being critical of the family and being critical of the norms of 50s, you know, TV 50s life, and instead turning to the individual and this the kind of having putting its faith in the spontaneous creative power of the individual, as if the individual isn't himself conflicted, and, you know, the sexuality in the movie is sort of naive and it's certainly not edible, you know. It's just a beautiful organic thing that erupts in the movie. So I was critical of Pleasantville because I thought this just confirms the one-dimensional society that we're living in many ways. It places everything onto the individual, and kind of fails to see the larger structures and that work in the world that shape the individual.
That tension about consciousness, though, and that tension about the individual and the relationship. I mean, that's where the consciousness talk for me has always failed. I mean, we talked about this in other podcasts before, but the assumption is somehow my consciousness is not distorted. Yours is. Let me show you the way. And I think this does lead to liberalism, and I'm going to get to maybe where things get a little bit more controversial. So they link the politically correct movement to cultural Marxism, and they use a book called The Authoritarian Personality. And that's a very early Frankfurt School book. It talks about like why people would be attracted to, of all classes, would be attracted to certain, you know, political movements, right? And they go and they actually do some social research and come up with this, you know, authoritarian scale. And it's pretty much the only social research that Adorno ever did. Everything else he does is theoretical. But that's like stopping really early in what they're talking about. Because if you read later, even Marcuse and stuff, you read the later stuff, it has almost nothing to do with that. Marcuse a little bit, but the rest of it doesn't. They talk about negative dialectics and the problems of the Enlightenment itself. And the funny thing is, a lot of these rightists may even agree with some of the things they would say about the Enlightenment, because what they're attacking is, you know, the Enlightenment dissolution of bonds. There was a very smart liberalish conservative called Daniel Bell in the 50s who actually talked about the irony of this, which is really funny. That all these conservatives, and particularly in the United States, tend to valorize capitalism without realizing that it's what's dissolving the community.
Marx has always said that what breaks the bonds of, you know, the old social forms, what breaks the bonds of the family, what breaks the bonds of the churches, isn't socialism. It's not communism that's doing that. That's capitalism. That's what he loves about capitalism. But that's what he sees is happening in the world under capitalism, which these Christians, I guess, don't actually ever say they like. They don't really address. They end up supporting capitalism, and that's when they really go off the rails in the end. But anyway,
right.
Go on.
Well, but that's actually a critique that many people have come to from different ends. People as diverse as Comet, even Sarazen, you know. All these kind of idealized communities that you might see from primitives and stuff, well, that's a reaction to capital melting stuff down. And it's interesting that the right, when they talk about cultural Marxism, doesn't want to like talk about that premise of cultural Marxism, because what they're saying is, you know, why people are becoming one-dimensional is like capitalism's eating up anything that you could latch onto for our community, and informal talk, it's talked about as the real subsumption of the individual to capital. And all kinds of people talk about it. It wasn't just the Frankfurt School. I mean, situationists are concerned with it. The ultra left and the Bourdieu tendencies are concerned with it. They all sort of talk about that. Now it gets creepy. I mean, like, for example, the Bourdieu answer to it, They talk about – what was it? They used – the most famous thing that may or may not have actually been written by Bourdieu is this essay called the Auschwitz Alibi, where it says that, you know, that removal of the population had to happen, and that's just the way the logic of capital runs. And that – I think that's actually what killed a lot of Bourdieuism, because it – a lot of people saw that as one step away from Holocaust denial. But
now, why was that Holocaust denial?
Well, they just thought it was like that. It was just seen as something had to happen. You couldn't fight it. There was no reason to fight it.
It was apologetics for it, but it didn't deny that it happened. Yeah, and he was saying that that's a determinist
view.
Yeah,
it's an ultra determinist view.
Right, and it's saying that as part of the dissolution of old values, something like the Holocaust was going to happen.
Right. And also because of the Jewish particularly weird relationship to capital, that they had seemingly benefited from the dissolution of values. And so they would be the natural scapegoat to get rid of as a surplus population. I mean, it is an argument that even makes me go, whoa, but it was part of the MU, and the Frankfurt School actually doesn't want to go that way. They don't want to say that it's inevitable. They want to talk about, you know, different parts of capital and how they play against each other. But ultimately, it doesn't go anywhere. I mean, the Frankfurt School split, like the Frankfurt School theorists, then they're still, like I said, they still exist. Habermas is famous. There's also Raymond Guest, who is very critical of both Habermas and Adorno. He's from that. There's Axel Honneth, who is involved in that. who has sort of gone back to looking at the structure of social systems. There's all sorts of people who've sort of gone beyond that. But from the Adorno-Marcuse-Horkheimer thread, Marcuse embraced the new left. Horkheimer gets to the point where he's so afraid of Stalinism that he actually starts, you know, supporting the Vietnam War.
Well, I just want to stop for a second longer on this argument that Bordega put forward that is considered to be Holocaust denial and anti-Semitic itself.
Well, okay. People don't say it's Holocaust denial, they say it's one step from it.
How different is that argument from Zizek's argument about what anti-Semitism is? Which is that anti-Semitism is when you find basically scapegoating a race or an ethnicity or a religion as the cause for, you know, the multiple levels of dissolution and crisis that are going on.
The difference is the level of determinism.
Right, that's it.
Right.
The difference is that Bordega is a hard determinist, and Zizek, I don't know what his position is on that. You know, he doesn't. Well, if you take that perspective, then there's no way to do anything political. I mean, you're just waiting for this mechanism to finish its job, I think. If you can't stand up and oppose the Holocaust, when are you going to intervene in politically?
I'll read the last line and you can. At the same time, all good democratic anti-fascists threw themselves on the corpses of the Jews. And since that time, they waved them under the nose of the proletariat. In order to make them feel capital's infamy, no, on the contrary, it's to make them to appreciate it. In contrast, the true democracy, the true progress, the true well-being that it employs in capitalist society. The horrors of capitalist death must make the proletariat forget the horrors of capitalist life. And the fact that the two are indissolubly connected. The experiments of the SS doctor must make them forget the capitalist experiments on the larger scale with carcinogenic products, on the effects of alcoholism and heredity, on the radioactivity of the democratic bombs. If they show lampshades made of human skin, is to make us forget capitalism transform living man into a lampshade anyway through his labor. The mountains of hair, the teeth of gold, the bodies of men turned into merchandise make us forget that capitalism make merchandise a living man. It is labor, man's very life, that capitalism transforms into merchandise.
Oh, Christ. That's just utter crap, in my opinion. Come on. There is a difference between the way capitalism exploits people and alienates them from their living labor and killing a million people and you know, piling up the bodies.
Seeing is like all this is being talked about as like the ultra left, right? Or not the ultra left, cultural Marxism, because they're not even making a difference between the traditional left and the ultra left. It's all the same thing to these guys. But like if you had thrown that at Adorno, he would have just stabbed you. Probably. I mean, like, because his whole life was talking about how, you know, the capitalism had tended towards that, but that, you know, that was the literalization of what was otherwise an abstract evil. And, you know, Bordiga is basically our pseudo Bordiga, let's just say. It's basically saying, you know, no, it's you know, it's not, and you shouldn't talk about it because it'll get other people to quit talking about what the real struggle is, which is,
oh, man.
And this is, you know, we forget all this now. We sort of, I think, even leftists sort of forget what all this was about, you know, and why it was so heated.
For the first time, Americans today are not free to say what they think. If they say something deemed offensive or insensitive or, worst of all, hate speech, they may be in serious trouble. They may be punished for violating the unholy commandments of the 90s, commonly known as political correctness. But is political correctness a new phenomenon? We'll show you tonight that political correctness has been in the making for more than 8 decades. And it seems that a deteriorating society is exactly what political correctness strives for. But just what is political correctness? As you're about to see, political correctness is nothing less than a Marxist ideology. Marxism translated from economic into cultural terms in an effort going back.
Sui, you were just going to jump in. Yeah, I was going to say that I feel like it's incredibly patronizing for you to paint these questions this way, especially as a white man. I don't expect you to be able to understand what people of color are actually saying with regards to cancel Colbert. He has a history of making jokes.
Sorry, being a white man doesn't prevent me from being able to think and doesn't prevent me from being able to have reasoned perspectives on things. I didn't give up my right to be able to have an intellectual conversation when I was born.
I know, but white men definitely feel like they're entitled to talk over me. They definitely feel like they're entitled to kind of minimalize my experiences, and they definitely feel like they are somehow exempt and so logical compared to women who are painted as emotional, right?
No one's minimalizing your experiences. No one's minimalizing your right to have an opinion. It's just a stupid opinion. I mean,
you just called my opinion stupid. That's incredibly unproductive, and I don't think I'm going to enact the labor of having to explain to you why that's incredibly offensive and patronizing.
Explain.
I just told you I wouldn't enact that labor.
Okay, thanks for being with us, Sui.
Excuse me. I haven't finished my point. My point is that this is what debates like this come down to. There's a civil way of putting racial prejudice. There's also a violence inherent in this discussion, and it comes out very, very easily.
You started it. That's the problem. You called him a racist.
He is a racist.
Yes.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much indeed.
Okay. Его остановил председатель ассамблеи и сказал, он сослался на телеграмму, которую он получил от своих братьев, которые страдают под колониальным гнетом. Председатель его остановил, говорил, что это вопрос по существу, а здесь обсуждается только лишь вопрос процедурного характера. А почему же этот халуй американского империализма выступает? Он затрагивает вопрос, если говорить, значит, он не процедурный вопрос затрагивает. И председатель, который симпатизирует колониальному господству.
Presentación de Cuba antes. Solo acataríamos acuerdos multilaterales con iguales obligaciones para todas las partes. Como ha dicho Fidel Castro, mientras el concepto de soberanía exista como prerrogativa de las naciones y de los pueblos independientes y como derecho de todos los pueblos, nosotros no aceptaremos la exclusión de nuestro pueblo de ese derecho. Mientras el mundo se rija por esos principios, mientras el mundo se rija por esos conceptos que tengan validez universal, porque son universalmente aceptados y consagrados por...
So what comes out of this, though, is interesting. So there was a bunch of feminists in the 70s, and this is where people find – when people who are paranoid, they want to find something that talks – makes cultural Marxism look real.
Mm-hmm.
They start talking about standpoint epistemology and standpoint feminism. So Darfy Smith was a Marxist teaching at Berkeley in the 70s. And she was reading Lukács, and she thought she found a way to talk about women's experience of, you know, patriarchy. And she said, you know, that the overall structure of society uses systemic oppression that devalues women's knowledge. And then women have a unique role because of their position in that matrix of production, which is something they had gotten. Darfy Smith had gotten from Lukács. And that we should, you know, valorize real lived experience as a way of encouraging consciousness of larger things of oppressions within the capitalist system. Now, that's not like actually what a lot of standpoint epistemologists, feminists believe today. Both Sarah Harding and Donna Haraway have moved it to situated knowledge to kind of get away from relativistic claims about people's lives. But when you encounter the way people talk about, you know, like my experience and it's not my job to teach you and all that, they are a lot of it comes out of standpoint theory. Interestingly, it also gets – it has a little bit of postmodern theory thrown in, which is where things get really confusing and don't make any sense because those two trends were opposed to each other. But they were reading Lukács, not the Frankfurt School, but the person who inspired the Frankfurt School, and they came up with this. And this is the language used in a lot of activist circles. And that's what people are responding to. So in the Gamergate thing – you know, all these people were freaking out about that, and they were like, well, it's the Marxist conspiracy. Well, they find out – they'll find out about intersectionality and read about bell hooks, and they'll find about Sarah Harding's modification of standpoint epistemology, and they'll find Darfy Smith, and then they'll read on Wikipedia that Darfy Smith was reading Lukács and Marx, and even though they don't mention that most Marx don't accept this at all. But and, you know – they talk about cultural feminism. Oh, that must be related to cultural Marxism. Bam, we have a straight line. But what I'm, you know, what I'm in my digressions, I'm trying to illustrate that straight line is actually horse caca.
Yeah, it's crooked.
But
there
are relationships. We can't say it doesn't have relationships to Marxism. It clearly does.
Right. It has relationships to Marxism often enough in direct opposition.
Right. But a lot of these people thought of themselves as Marxists, though.
Or as post-Marxist, which is the real Marxism. You know, I've corrected, I've improved. I'm a Marxist because I've improved Marx. I've taken what's true in Marx and developed something new that is still, I'll call it Marxism, but it's not what Marx wrote.
I mean, and that's the thing that's really hard to talk about. So when they talk about cultural Marxism, they're linking all this. But if we actually disaggregate it a bit, what we see is there's three completely crazily conflicting ideas that are becoming encapsulated in one politics.
Yeah, I want to talk about the part where they talk about the peace movement as the fifth column of the enemy being who, you know, by my God, I mean, there is no one enemy anymore. That's just nuts to think of the
I'm thinking, column. I don't know how old that is either, because I'm wondering, given the suits they're wearing, if that's from the 80s and they literally mean the Soviet Union.
Yeah, they probably do. I don't know when that is made. So, but certainly now the peace movement is not the fifth column of any nation state, particularly.
The peace movement lately does seem to go out of its way to like derail things. For example, the whole thing on the Daily Coast where they were talking when they brought up the ISIS burning the Jordanian guy. And now they could have brought up legitimately like someone like Glenn Greenwald does about, you know, how all these bombs that we're dropping on people are burning people alive. You know, like that would be sort of a legitimate politics, but they don't bring that up at all. They bring up lynching.
Which is basically what? What is that? The point there is to say the United States is retrograde and, you know, is the worst evil, basically, worse than ISIS.
Right. I mean, but the thing is, like, if we did collective agency that way, here's the problem with this. Even though this is the weird thing about all this individual stuff. If you believe in all this individual humanity crap and all this, you know, moral nation, you know, and it's all about the morality of the nation. And you also believe that individuals are reflective of that. Then you have to believe that all this has to do with individual choices and that this is a moral problem. And if we point out how awful things in the United States, maybe we won't fight these other things that create ISIS. But that doesn't – there's so much more standing to reason. One, that assumes that everything that goes on everywhere else in the world is just a reaction to the United States. Not even the capitalism, just to the United States, which is some crazy American exceptionalism if you really think about it. Two, it literally is projecting like structures of the past as if they're actively done now, and we can talk about stuff as done now as if it's actively the same thing. And if yes, if someone was saying, oh, well, all these dirty Muslims or Arabs, they're just burning people, then that might be a normal response. But they're not they're pretending people are saying that when they're not. Like, people aren't – a lot of the people who are talking about ISIS are not talking about Arabs in general. Even Muslims in general are, you know, the other in general. They're talking about that specific group. And, you know, we could go not all blah, but that's the thing that everyone does right now, right? If they go not all blah, like, yes, systemically it is all. But it's not – you're confusing a moral problem with a systemic problem. You're not making a distinction between them. And I can see why right-wingers – actually, I can see why right-wingers would encourage that in a way they do, because – what it does is it shuts things down to the point where basically everything can go on like it is. You can't discuss any meaningful way to talk about any of this. Because it's not like talking about lynching in the 1910s and ISIS now is going to start do away with police racism against you know, black people who are in the surplus population in the inner cities and are thus killed all the time. Just that's literally not relevant to it. In fact, it'll confuse the matter because the cops who are killing a lot of these black kids are often minorities themselves.
They're not doing it for the same reasons, in the same way. You know, it's you start, if you hold up lynchings as the standard, you give your opponents the opportunity to take a look at the killing in, I think it was Rhode Island or with, where was it? The guy who, Garner, Eric Garner, and say, oh, that's not a lynching. That was a mistake.
It gets everyone outraged, but it does nothing to change anything. And it actually, like, sends people in a wrong direction. And interestingly, this was something that the Frankfurt School was critical of, you know, that these right-wingers say that they're endorsing, but they talk about actionism, which is where you just do stuff without thinking about, like, you feel like, oh, there's oppression, so we must do it now, but without even trying to draw out the consequences of it. Now, I think Adorno took this in the wrong direction, where eventually he thinks, like, thinking is the ultimate liberation of mankind, and he more or less says that in an essay called Resignation that he wrote at the end of his life. But which we've talked about,
yeah. The thing I wanted to point out, just back to the video, was there's that whole critique of Pleasantville, and I thought to myself, what would Adorno say about Pleasantville? How would he react to that movie? I mean, I'm sure he'd be going out. Yeah, he'd be throwing up. I mean, he would friggin' hate. He'd hate that movie a lot more than I did, right?
No, I mean, he would see it as like. You know, people being made believe their sexuality and commodity choices free them in some fundamental way that they don't.
So going back to the video again at the end, which that's okay. We're talking about political correctness. They're talking about political correctness. We've been talking about it for a while. And one of the things that I noted just as they were talking about this was that their nationalism and their hatred of government seem to be contradictory.
Yeah, it's like nationalism and patriotism, but government's bad, but go and die for it.
It was incoherent. And then the claim that various civil rights lawsuits are behind the problem in the economy and responsible for low wages was my favorite moment in the whole thing. Because it's a kind of claim that is so just nakedly wrong and also just vicious, you know? It's like saying, you're saying to basically poor white people, it's because the blacks and the Hispanics are trying to get, you know, fair wages or keep their homes that you don't have a good wage.
That's where it becomes blatantly absurd and where it really breaks down. And it's also where you understand, but you understand if you're disillusioned. Dude, even additional people always think this is white dudes. I've met a lot of people who believe this stuff who are minorities. Rarely are they black. I will say that, but there's a lot. I met a lot of people who believe this stuff who are other kinds of minorities. And this is going to sound really appealing. It's going to explain something. And like, it's because particularly if you can do what the grim back chartboard thing and talk about the relationships. And what normally happens when liberals is they just deny that their relationships are there. I'll give you another example, like FDR Stalin stuff. The people who got mad at me for pointing out a lot of the stuff that FDR did in favor of Stalin were not communists. In fact, they knew what I was saying was true. It was liberals who think of themselves as anti-communist, but cannot believe that they would have ever done those things. You know, like send moderate socialists to their death as a concession at the end of World War II, or allowed Stalin to sort out Europe along racial lines. They just don't believe that. I mean, I don't know how they do it, because you have to blatantly deny history or say that there were no Soviet spies in the Roosevelt cabinet, which is just nuts. There were. We know for a fact there were. There's also, we had spies in the Soviet. I mean, like, it's just the way stuff works. I'm not saying that, like, oh, they had infiltrated it and they were everywhere, but they were there.
You know, of all of our conversation, I think the thing that's most worth underlining is the fact that some of the incoherence of the liberal left plays into this narrative about cultural Marxism. It's as if, especially like I saw this online in Twitter debates, it's as if the liberal side of a debate is doing everything it can to fulfill every stereotype that these fascist cultural Marxist fearing jerk-offs are talking about.
You know, part of that comes, there's a lot of reasons for that. Some of that's the incoherence of ideas. Some of that's as liberals have been watching conservatives do that with think tanks for so long that they just think, well, maybe we should just start doing it ourselves. And they are. And they understand, like, conservatives realized in the 90s what liberals have realized in the last 5 years about shock jock culture and what we now call clickbait. They know how to do it, and they know how to feed a confirmation bias. As Marxists, there's a temptation to think, oh, well, this is helping us raise consciousness. We can use this for revolution. It's all practical. What I had pointed out, for the right-wingers, this has always bit them in the ass. Because eventually, they believe their own bullshit. And what I get afraid of with a lot of leftists is I think we start believing our own bullshit too. Like we should know it's bullshit, but we start to believe it.
Revolutionary action.
Hi, Dr. Betty Brown here. The topic is German Expressionism.
Revolutionary action.
Expressionist artists were some of the most passionate and troubled artists of the early 20th century.
Revolutionary action.
They sought to challenge, rebel against, and certainly comment on the state of the world in Germany. And they did it with really powerful and compelling art.
Revolutionary action.
I want to mention two German Expressionist artists whose work continues to move me. The first is Kate Kollwitz, who was a sculptor, but most importantly, a printmaker. She started her career doing work that supported political action of workers, rebelling against the abuses of factory owners who cut their pay and cut their benefits and led them to starvation.
Revolutionary action.
Another German artist who stayed under Hitler and protests the horrible abuses of that leader was John Hartfield, who took his name, an American name, as a sign of protest, and he used collage and photomontage as a way to protest Hitler's political abuses.
Revolutionary action.
Half Hatfield was the first artist in the world to realize that the simple technique of photomontage could become a powerful political weapon. The same editing techniques that create cinema make photomontage when applied to still. These basic methods of assembling images run through film, television, photography, and advertising.
Good morning, Mr. Cooper. Today, you are going to brush your teeth 42% cleaner with Sunbeam's new revolutionary action. Up and down and around at the same time. It can clean 42% better than ordinary hand brushing.
Na 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 na